Today is July 11th, 2018. If you feel lucky, we'll just say it's 7-Eleven today. Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question a little differently. Do you know who's using your personal data? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the programs available on wbai.org/archive. Also on prn.fm and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5, New York on the radio, and prn.fm on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive. The programs are different. Tonight, WBAI is on a membership drive. The Liberty County Vindicator, which is a community newspaper between Houston and Beaumont, had been posting the whole Declaration of Independence in small daily chunks for 9 days on its Facebook page in a run-up to July 4th. But the 10th excerpt was not posted, and the paper said it received an automated notice from Facebook saying that the post goes against our standards on hate speech. Part of the standard notice, Vindicated managing editor said, included a warning that the newspaper could lose its Facebook account, on which it depends for much of its reach, if there were more violations. Hate speech? What was the offending passage? Well, it was part of the document's Bill of Particulars against Britain's King George III. He had excited domestic insurrection amongst us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sex, and conditions. Well, once Facebook realized that they had been labeling the Declaration of Independence hate speech, they apologized for it, and they restored the capability to make the final post. According to the Vindicator's managing editor, in an apology email to the newspaper, Facebook wrote, "It looked like we made a mistake and removed something that you posted on Facebook that didn't go against our community standards. We want to apologize and let you know that we've restored your content and remove any blocks on your account related to this incorrect action." Don't they realize that that is in a subjective voice and not the objective voice when you say, "We want to apologize"? You haven't apologized. Just say, "We apologize." We should learn how to use proper English these days. While the Vindicator cannot be certain exactly what triggered Facebook's filtering program, the editor suspect was most likely the phrase Indian savages, and the editor said perhaps had Thomas Jefferson written it as Native Americans at a challenging stage of cultural development, that would have been better. He blamed the incident on an automated action. The removal of the post was an automated action, and if any human beings working at Facebook were to review it, no doubt the post would be allowed. A Facebook spokesperson told CNN that the post was removed by mistake and restored as soon as we looked into it. They process millions of reports each week, and sometimes they do get things wrong. Yeah, but you picked the Declaration of Independence to go wrong. The spokesperson added that the mistake was due to not recognizing that the passage was from this famous document. Facebook has come under criticism for not being transparent enough about how it decides what it is or isn't to be banned, and has at times appeared inconsistent in the applications of its own rules. Most recently, Facebook fought accusations that it censored conservative personalities like Diamond and Silk in the United States. Human rights groups have complained about its handling of hate-filled posts linked to the violence in countries like Myanmar. Facebook had made effort to share how it handles such issues, and they said that on defining, addressing, and contextualizing hate speech in a news release last summer, that they were committed to removing hate speech anytime they become aware of it. They noted that the process is not perfect, and it's clear that they're not perfect in coming up with enforcing their own policy. Often there are close calls, and too often they get it wrong. Their mistakes have caused a great deal of concern in a number of communities, including among groups who feel that, well, that was acted out of bias. I can understand the problem that Facebook has because, on the one hand, they cannot say that they're just a carrier of information like the telecom companies, because the European Union has said they are responsible for privacy. They are now responsible for content that they themselves did not generate. It does not appear that the folks at Facebook want anyone contacting them, or at least they do not make it easy for anyone to contact them. I suggest they be open-minded and let people come up with different ideas on how they can regulate, I hate to use the word regulate, but how they handle hate speech. And if they do it on their own, whatever staff members they have, they do have an individual bias, and you must have a greater community group reviewing it, and they should share that responsibility. Facebook relaxed its rules to give these 61 companies special access to user data. Facebook told U.S. lawmakers that while it imposed new data sharing restrictions on most app developers in May 2015, 61 companies received special one-time extensions. The list of companies includes Nike, Spotify, UPS, and other well-named corporations. It is unclear why these companies received the extension. In addition to this, Facebook found 5 companies that theoretically could have access as a result of beta tests. The revelation comes after Cambridge Analytica scandal, in which the data of up to 87 million Facebook users was compromised. Facebook has confessed to breaking its own rules to give 61 companies special access to user data. In a 747-page document handed to the U.S. House of Representatives committees recently, Facebook said app developers could request Facebook data, including name, gender, birthdate, location, photos, and page likes. In April 2014, Facebook introduced a new, more restrictive API or application program interface, requiring that new apps go through a review and approval process, and preventing new apps from accessing friends' data without review. It also gave users more granular control over the data an app operating on the new platform could access. Most existing applications on the platform had until May 2015 to comply with these changes before being migrated to the new API and becoming subject to the new review and approval process. But 61 companies given extension? My. It's not clear, by the way, that these 61 companies receive extra time to adjust or adapt to the new restrictions. Facebook also acknowledged that it discovered 5 companies could have theoretically gained access to restricted friends' data as a result of a beta test. These companies were Activision, Fundershoot, Golden Union Company, IQ Zone, and Peak Social. The world's greatest literature, reference, and business books are readily available on your PC, tablet, and smartphone. Whatever you want to do, books will help you to do it. Whether it's changing careers, learning a new skill, or simply escaping to another world for a few hours, the right books will get you there. There is Project Gutenberg, gutenberg.org. Project Gutenberg is the oldest digital library in the world. Founded in 1971, it has mostly specialized in digitizing classics whose copyright expired and that are now in the public domain. Now it has over 54,000 e-books, which you can search for by title, author, or keyword. If you're not looking for a specific book, you can browse the collection by bookshelf, which is Project Gutenberg's name for categories.
The categories don't drill down very deeply, so I recommend having some idea of what you like to read first. A title, author, or subject would be ideal. You can also browse by title, author, language, and recently published. You can download it in a variety of formats, including plain text, HTML, PDF, MOBI, EPUB, and Plucker. That covers pretty much all devices, and you don't even need to register to start reading. The reading matter that is available is free. The great literature classics are in the library. If you prefer audiobooks, there's LibriVox. That's LibriVox.org. Started in 2005, LibriVox is a library of free audiobooks read by volunteers. Although audiobooks aren't technically ebooks, this is a great way of enjoying books on the move, keeping you entertained and informed on your morning commute. The LibriVox library uses Project Gutenberg's titles, with the Internet Archives hosting the audio. That means you mostly have access to classics. For some, this might be an easy way of familiarizing yourself with literature if you don't have the time to read the books themselves or if your sight is impaired. As well as being able to listen online, you can download the titles in MP3 format for use at home and on your mobile phone. There are links to the ebook versions on each title's page, and they run a twice-weekly podcast if you prefer to listen that way. All books are recorded in 128 kilobits, which makes it for a pleasant, artifact-free listening. So there you have two great websites with millions of ebook titles to choose from. All the classics are there and many others too. So it's time to familiarize yourself with Dickens or just while away the hours with a bit of romance, hit the free books first and save yourself some cash. Oh, first let me just digress for a moment. Tomorrow, March the 29th, is the first day of the 2018 baseball season. All the teams are scheduled on this opening day. I grew up as a New York Yankee fan starting back in 1947, but I became a Met fan in 1962. Casey Stengel was the first Met manager, and he was quite a character. In 1962, which was their first year of play, the New York Mets set a professional baseball record that has yet to be broken on the way, unfortunately, to become futile but lovable losers. They lost 120 games in a season. And this reminded me of the poem Casey at the Bat. I downloaded this audio poem from LibriVox to share with you.
Casey at the Bat by Ernest Lawrence Thayer. Read for LibriVox.org by Ostrey Fingerhut. It looked extremely rocky for the Mudville Nine that day. The score stood 4-6 with just an inning left to play. And so when Cooney died at first, and Burroughs did the same, a pallor wreathed the features of the patrons of the game. A straggling few got up to go, leaving there the rest, with that hope that springs eternal within the human breast. For they thought if only Casey could get one whack, at that they'd put up even money with Casey at the bat. But Flynn preceded Casey, and so likewise did Blake, but the former was a pudding, and the latter was a fake. So on that stricken multitude a death-like silence sat, for there seemed but little chance of Casey's getting to the bat. But Flynn let drive a single to the wonderment of all, and the much-despised Blakey tore the cover off the ball, and when the dust had lifted and they saw what had occurred, there was Blakey safe on second, and Flynn a-huggin' third. Then from the gladdened multitude went up a joyous yell. It bounded from the mountaintop and rattled in the dell. It struck upon the hillside and rebounded on the flat, for Casey, mighty Casey, was advancing to the bat. There was ease in Casey's manner as he stepped into his place. There was pride in Casey's bearing, and a smile on Casey's face. And when responding to the cheers, he lightly doffed his hat. No stranger in the crowd could doubt 'twas Casey at the bat. 10,000 eyes were on him as he rubbed his hands with dirt. 5,000 tongues applauded when he wiped them on his shirt. Then while the writhing pitcher ground the ball into his hip, defiance glanced in Casey's eye. A sneer curled Casey's lip. And now the leather-covered sphere came hurtling through the air, and Casey stood a-watchin' it in haughty grandeur there. Close by the sturdy batsman the ball unheeded sped. "That ain't my style," said Casey. "Strike one," the umpire said. From the benches black with people there went up a muffled roar, like the beating of the storm waves on a stern and distant shore. "Kill him! Kill the umpire!" shouted someone in the stand, and it's likely they'd have killed him had not Casey raised his hand. With a smile of Christian charity, great Casey's visage shone. He stilled the rising tumult. He bade the game go on. He signaled to the pitcher, and once more the spheroid flew, but Casey still ignored it, and the umpire said, "Strike two!" "Fraud!" cried the maddening thousands, and the echo answered, "Fraud!" But the scornful look from Casey and the audience was odd. They saw his face grow stern and cold, they saw his muscles strain, and they knew that Casey wouldn't let that ball go by again. The sneer is gone from Casey's lip. His teeth are clenched with hate. He pounds with cruel violence his bat upon the plate. And now the pitcher holds the ball, and now he lets it go, and now the air is shattered by the force of Casey's blow. Oh, somewhere in this favored land the sun is shining bright. The band is playing somewhere, and somewhere hearts are light, and somewhere men are laughing. And somewhere children shout. But there is no joy in Mudville. Mighty Casey has struck out. End of poem. This recording is in the public domain.
Hey, I've been going over the plans for our cybernetic house to determine where the power receptacles and the wall switches should go. It's painstaking work, and I'm sure I don't have to tell you where it's a pain. Along the way, I learned a lot about electrical code requirements and about human nature. I hope you find today's upcoming avalanche of information somehow useful, and let me remind you, the intention of this project is to come up with a house that you build once and it then goes 40 or more years without needing any major maintenance or repairs. That factor may influence me to change some of what's in, well, the tally you're about to hear. But first, a few bits of philosophy. One is that electrical line power will never connect to any of the wall switches in this house, and not beyond the few volts and the fraction of a milliamp that it takes to let them function as inputs to the control system. I want them to be recognizable to people as switches, so I'm using decorator-style momentary switches with specifications way beefier than they need to be, but that's a good thing because, happily, handling less juice helps keep them working longer. Second, I'm sick and tired of needing outlet multipliers and power strips and extension cords. Almost everywhere in this house that I put receptacles, it's a six-pack. Meaning a three-gang box of duplex outlets. I distribute them very generously in hopes that no one will ever need an extension cord to reach one. All of the power feeds in the house, well, there are a couple of small exceptions, all of the power feeds in the house are 20 amps, and most of the receptacles are 20 amps. A few special purpose ones are more easily available to me in 15 amp, and in at least one case, that's a good thing. Third, the outdoor receptacles are four packs, not six packs, two gang boxes with two duplex receptacles because two gang weatherproof while-in-use covers, that's a trade term. While-in-use is a trade term that means you can bring a cord out the bottom even when the cover is closed. Well, those are easily available in two gang. I haven't found them in three gang. So, you know, not a bad choice. Just in case four outlets aren't enough, again, I've been generous in placing these around the yard. There are 10 places in the house where somebody might want to put a TV set. I'm putting a recessed 15-amp outlet fairly high on the wall in each of these locations. Now, these are outlets that I'm adapting, because it's probably not a nice thing to say hacking, so the control system can know whether the TV that's plugged into one is actually on and drawing more than 25 to 30 watts. These wall positions are high enough for the TV set to cover them up, or if there's no TV there, to hide them behind a picture or some artwork. I promised you some numbers. There are 10 places in the house with those TV outlets. There are 24 places in the house, all low on the wall, where the center duplex receptacle in the three-gang box has a pair of LEDs and a photo sensor built in, so it can provide a small nightlight that only turns on in the dark. Now, these little nightlight receptacles, they're one of the other places where I use 15-amp outlets, but the pair on each side of it is 20 amps each, and I figured 4 out of 6 in these specific 24 locations would be okay. Those momentary decorator switches that only connect to the control system are always in trios. In a few cases, there are 6 switches in over and under trios, and the total count of all those switches is 102. 102 wall switches in the house. Maybe. Sometimes I add. The total count of duplex receptacles is, well, kind of big. It's 331 duplex receptacles, meaning 662 outlets, and they're not all. We also use 20 with indoor GFCI and 50 with weather-resistant GFCI, a grand total of 812 places where you can plug something in, not counting the connections for major appliances, the HVAC system, and so on. They're most closely packed at the workbench in the bonus room, at the workbench in the garage, and at the kitchen counter. I should probably also mention 154 three-gang electrical boxes, 30 two-gang boxes, and 10 single-gang boxes, 45 three-gang floor covers, 41 two-gang outdoor violin use covers, and 98 wall covers, nylon, so they won't snap and crack. If you haven't just gone through building a house or a major remodeling, you might not be caught up on all of the electrical code requirements that I have to face here. Every one of these outlets is tamper-proof. That's a fairly recent requirement. It means that there are little shutters covering the slots where the plug blades go. And that, in turn, means two other things. One is that plugs are a little harder to get into the socket than ever before. For you, it may just mean a little more muscle. But electricians tell me that some of their elderly clients are complaining that it's become impossible for them. That bit of an extra challenge comes with some companion good news. It's also more difficult for plugs to slip out of the outlet, something that happens to me way too often when an unrelated act pulls on a cord. It's safer if that plug can help itself stay in. Which leads me to something else in the code that most people don't know. It's not yet a requirement for residences, but in the code for other places. As you look at an outlet, you see a long blade slot, a short blade slot, and a round hole for the ground post. Do you think an outlet is right side up with the ground post up or the ground post down? I grew up thinking ground goes down. It's what I'm used to seeing. I'm sure it's what a lot of you are used to seeing, but that's changing. The new standard calls for ground up and blades down. The reasoning may sound a little bit like the Three Stooges meet Plinko. Here's the idea. A plug comes slightly out of the wall and something metal, maybe a wire coat hanger, slides down the wall. With the blades on top and exposed, that can lead to a short and maybe enough heat to start a fire. With the blades down, whatever might have shorted them hits the ground post instead and might bounce off or, like Plinko, fall in a nearly random direction, hopefully on a path that won't short either blade to ground. But if not, there's a 50-50 chance that the blade it hits will be neutral, and with proper wiring, neutral to ground is a non-event. Well, I surrender. I'm installing ground up top and blades down below. And then there's GFCI. It used to be that only a few outlets around the house required GFCI protection. Now it's almost every outlet in the garage, all except the one on the ceiling for the garage door opener. Everything at countertop height in the kitchen and every bathroom, everything outdoors, everything in the basement or crawl space. But I better clarify what I mean by GFCI protection. If you're in a store or anywhere else where you can look at the back of a GFCI unit that doesn't have any wires connected to it, you'll see that two of the connectors are labeled line and two are labeled load. The line connector connects to the power line feed. That's a direction that electricians call upstream. You can connect other outlets in the same gang box or others to the load connection, and they will all be GFCI protected. But now we're back to philosophy. I don't like stringing too many outlets to one GFCI because if it ever trips, none of those outlets will have any power, no matter how far they are from the point of the fault that made it trip. I'm happy to put a GFCI into every box and connect it to the one or two other duplex outlets in that box, but whatever happens will only impact those outlets. Two other things about the GFCI. First, they are now all required to self-test. The Hubble products that I like perform self-tests every 30 seconds. And second, if you're creating something that you want to be able to dodge maintenance in for a very long time, I strongly suggest that you look at weather-resistant GFCIs, even for the ones that are indoors. They're made with different materials like stainless steel and nylon, so they're much less susceptible to damage from cold or wetness or corrosion. I said that my design has 50 places for weather-resistant GFCI and 20 places where standard will do. I think I'd be pretty smart to just order 70 that are weather-resistant. And despite their high count, I'm considering doing the same with all of the non-GFCI duplex outlets if I can find good weather-resistant alternatives. I think you know that my control system keeps tabs on which outlets do or don't have power. I'm not actually doing that for every outlet. I don't have to, because I am doing it for one outlet in every box. That's 155 places, and I already know there will be more. There are two reasons I think it's worth doing, at least in a place where I already have an intelligent control system. One is because when a GFCI trips, the peril to a person could be real, so it's worth knowing about it and responding immediately. The other is because if some outlets on the same breaker are on and some are off, it could mean any of several kinds of problems with the wiring in the walls, some of which can cause fires. I think that's something I'd like to avoid. Knowing which breakers serve which outlets and in what order they're connected upstream can be a huge help if there's ever a problem. It's a process called mapping. I'm just beginning the process now. Beyond those hundreds of receptacles, I must separately feed power to lighting fixtures on their own runs, non-socketed hardwired junctions to equipment like pumps, and remotely to the gazebo. Even farther upstream, close to the electricity headwaters, I also need to connect to the generator because line power is never fully assured. Hank and I keep reminding you how important it is to back up, back up, back up.
Thank you, Marty.
You're probably used to sorting your garbage into bins, green for paper or blue for plastic and glass, but when it comes to electronics, we're still used to selling those off or tossing them into the trash can. But if you have takers such as a charitable organization that can really use the equipment, you will need to clean out the data stored on the disk drive first. You are, however, not doing any charitable organizations any favor with equipment more than two generations old. Unfortunately, our gadget addiction has real consequences for the planet, making it very necessary that we dispose of everything responsibly and properly. Sure, you can try parting with your stuff for cash, but it's a pain and it could be tough, if not impossible, to find someone who wants a system running Windows 95 with a 20-year-old CRT. Few places have curbside pickup. In fact, some localities make it illegal to leave electronics for the garbage collectors, so you're going to have to find a reputable center to take it. There are some outlets to help you dispense of your broken and unwanted computers, televisions, and any other computer gear that is not really being used as a doorstop, it's just taking up space. There is no national electronics recycling law at this time, so you won't find any federal programs to assist you with getting rid of old devices. The Post Office does run a program for federal agencies and their employees, but it's not available to the general public. Instead, the rest of us have to rely on nationwide retailers to toss out our old stuff. Best Buy has over 1,000 locations in the United States, so it's likely you have one nearby you where you can drop the stuff off. You just need to take it to the customer service counter. They'll issue you a receipt, but keep in mind that you can't claim the drop-off as a deduction on your taxes since Best Buy isn't a charity. You can even recycle televisions and monitors, though you'll be charged a fee of $25 per item
to cover the higher cost of transporting and disassembling them. Best Buy limits you to 3 items per household per day, including up to 2 televisions. There are only 300 Staples stores nationwide, but it has some perks over Best Buy. You can bring up to 7 items per day, and if you recycle a printer, you can get $50 off a new one. Recycling your stuff follows the same process. Just bring your products to the customer service center for receipt. Staple Rewards members also receive a small credit of $2 for every used ink cartridge they turn in, and up to 20 a month. Unfortunately, Staples does not recycle televisions. Office Depot has over 1,300 locations to choose from, but unlike Staples and Best Buy, it won't recycle your old gadgets for free. If you're only getting rid of a few phones or batteries, well, those can still be turned in at no charge. But for everything else, you must purchase a tech recycle box, which costs $5, $10, or $15, depending on the size. You can fill it with as many items as you want, provided they all fit inside, and this includes smaller televisions. So it's a great deal if you have a lot of stuff that you want to dispose of, and if you're looking to turn in some ink cartridges, Office Depot also offers $2 per cartridge, but only if you make a purchase of $10 or more in the same month. If you can't make it to a retail location, especially when you only need to get rid of one or two items, many companies offer recycling programs for their own products. They'll even pay for shipping. Some run their own programs while others use outside organizations. While Amazon would love to direct you to a trade-in program, you're probably reading this post because there's stuff you can't sell, and for those items, Amazon offers mail-in recycling. You can send in your busted Kindles, your Fire TVs, and even dash buttons, as well as select peripherals like keyboards and mouse pointers. You'll just need to fill out some forms online and generate a shipping label, which you can slap on any box. Drop it off at a UPS location, and you're good to go. Amazon will cover all the cost. If your iPhone or MacBook is still in good shape, you should consider selling it, but if it's old or beat up, you can still score a gift card by turning it into Apple's recycling program. For iPhones, iPad, and Apple Watches, you'll be asked to fill out a form attesting to the product's condition and given a trade-in quote. With a working iPhone 5 going for $35, an iPhone 7 Plus will get you $315, and for Macs, you'll be asked to provide a serial number as well. Though Apple won't give you any cash for anything deemed old or unacceptable, you can still mail it in and bring it to any Apple store so it can be responsibly disposed of. Dell offers drop-off recycling via a partnership with Goodwill. Not every location participates, but there are over 2,000 of them. And because it's a charity, you may even be able to deduct it as a donation off your taxes. Dell also has a mail-back program on its site where you can generate a shipping label and drop-off package off at a FedEx location. You can ship old products back to Epson by simply creating a shipping label on its site and dropping it off at a FedEx location. If you can, HP recommends taking its product to the nearest Best Buy or Staple, but if that's not feasible, the company participates in a program that will even buy back some items. You'll be asked to fill out a form with the make, model, and condition, and the recycler will email you a prepaid shipping label to mail the package within 30 days. If you're doing a buyback, you'll receive a paper check in the mail. Because this isn't an in-house program with HP, you can also send in items from other companies. Many other companies use outside recyclers to dispose of their products, and you'll often see the same names popping up again and again across different manufacturers. This should simplify things in some cases. You should be able to send in products from multiple sources in one package. You just need to fill in the make and the model to generate a prepaid shipping label. However, different states have different rules on what you can return so that the drop-down for selecting your product may vary by jurisdiction. Two major recycling companies you'll notice a lot are RLGA, which covers Acer, Canon, Google, Intel, Lenovo, Microsoft and Motorola products, and MRM, which recycles products for Alcatel, BlackBerry, Barnes & Noble, TCL, and Toshiba. Cell phones are the easiest gadgets to recycle. If you haven't already decided to sell yours off on eBay, Declutter, Gazelle, and Echo ATM, but if you can't or won't make some cold hard cash off of it, you can send it to Call2Recycle. That's C-A-L-L, numeric 2, R-E-C-Y-C-L-E, which has drop-off centers all over the country in many chain stores, including Lowe's and Home Depot. They also accept rechargeable batteries as well. Cell phones for soldiers can be made, which accepts phones in any condition and sell them to refurbishers or recyclers. The proceeds go toward purchasing phone cards for troops so they can call their friends and families back home. To be clear, the phones are not given directly to the soldiers. All four of the major carriers, including Verizon and T-Mobile, offer free recycling as well. You can trade in your old device in the store or send it in for a credit towards a new phone or let them straight up recycle it. AT&T participates in cell phones for soldiers while Sprint runs the 1 million project, which works to get disadvantaged kids' devices and internet access. If you do decide to try your luck with Gazelle or Echo ATM to see if your old phone is still worth a few bucks, and it turns out it's worth nothing, you can at least rest easy knowing that both companies will recycle your phone responsibly. There may not be a national law dictating that you must recycle your electronics, but at least 26 states have passed their own laws that vary widely in what they demand of both manufacturers and consumers. Almost all states that do collect products for recycling provide the service for free, with a bill footed by the companies in some way. Most provide some local programs to help you rid of your stuff, regardless of whether recycling your gadgets is required or optional. States where you can no longer dispose of electronics in the regular trash and must recycle them include California, Connecticut, Illinois, Indiana, Maine, Minnesota, New Jersey, New York, North Carolina, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, South Carolina, Vermont, West Virginia, Wisconsin, and the District of Columbia. The following states have been requiring manufacturers to pay for recycling, but you, the consumer, are not actually required to recycle your electronics, and they are Hawaii, Maryland, Michigan, Missouri, Oklahoma, Texas, Virginia, and the state of Washington. The following states have some special circumstances worth noting. California consumers pay a small fee of $5 to $7 when they buy televisions and laptops. This is used to reimburse recyclers for the high cost of recycling these items, so you don't get it back when you turn in these items for collection. Connecticut does not allow recycling centers to charge you a fee for turning in electronics, so many organizations that would usually charge for recycling televisions and monitors do not accept them. Since you cannot dispose of them curbside, you can take them to a municipal transfer station for free. In Michigan, in addition to hosting numerous drop-off sites, Michigan will pay for you to recycle your old gadgets by mail. Pennsylvania does not allow retailers to charge you a fee to recycle, so places like Best Buy and Staples will not accept televisions or monitors. Many recycling centers have also closed as a result of underfunding. Some nonprofit recyclers may still accept the items, and you should check to see if your local government is hosting any drop-off events. Lancaster and Dauphin counties still run civic recycling programs. With it becoming more difficult to rid of an old TV in Pennsylvania, with some people even resorting to illegal dumping, so if you have something to recycle, check the laws, go on the website and find out what you can and cannot do, as it varies from site to site. And this will be followed up in a future broadcast. If you want to give away the equipment, we'll go through how you can clean the information off your hard drive before you do it. Based on new reporting, the Internet Crime Complaint Center, otherwise known as IC3, is providing updated guidance regarding technical support fraud. Technical support fraud involves a criminal claiming to provide customer security or technical support in an effort to defraud unwitting individuals. This type of fraud continues to be a problematic and, well, a widespread scam. Last year, in 2017, the IC3 received approximately 11,000 complaints related to tech support fraud. The claim losses amounted to nearly $15 million, which represented an 80% increase from 2016. And most of this is probably just the tip of the iceberg, as a lot of it is unreported. While majority of the tech support fraud involves victims in the United States, IC3 has received complaints from victims in 85 different countries. Criminals may pose as a security, customer, or technical support rep, offering to resolve such issues as a compromised email or bank account, a virus on your computer, or to assist with a software license renewal. Some recent complaints involve criminals posing as technical support reps for GPS, printer, or cable companies, or provide for virtual currency exchanges. As this type of fraud has become a more commonplace, criminals have started to pose as government agents, even offering to recover supposed losses related to tech support fraud schemes or to request financial assistance with apprehending criminals. How the fraud occurs. Initial contact with a victim typically occurs through the following methods. Telephone. A victim receives an unsolicited telephone call from an individual claiming the victim's device or computer is infected with a virus or is sending error messages to the caller. Callers are generally reported to have strong foreign accents. Individuals in need of tech support may use online search engines to find technical support companies. Companies pay to have their fraudulent tech support company links show higher in search results, hoping victims would choose one of the top links in search results. Pop-up message. The victim receives an on-screen pop-up message claiming a virus has been found on their computer. In order to receive assistance, the message requests the victim call a phone number associated with a fraudulent tech support company. Lock screen on a device. The victim's device displays a frozen lock screen with a phone number and instructions to contact a fraudulent tech support company. Some victims have reported being redirected to alternate websites before the lock screen occurs. By the way, if you get a lock screen, just turn off the machine, bring it up again. That's how you bypass it. Pop-up and lock screens, often accompanied by a recorded verbal message to contact a phone number for assistance. Frequently programmed into links for advertising or popular topics on social media. Web addresses of popular websites such as social media or financial websites can be typo squatted to result in a pop-up or locked screen if the victim incorrectly types the intended website address. Phishing is another form of email warning. The victim receives a phishing email warning of a possible intrusion into their computer or email warning of a fraudulent account charged to their bank account or credit card. The email provides a phone number for the recipient to contact the fraudulent tech support. If you get that, and if the number is not recognizable or you're familiar with, ignore it. Don't worry about being sued because you didn't respond to it. Once the fraudulent tech support company makes the verbal contact with the victim, the criminal tries to convince the victim to provide remote access to the victim's device. If the device is a tablet or smartphone, the criminal often instructs the victim to connect the device to a computer. Once remotely connected, the criminal claims to find expired licenses, viruses, malware, or scareware. The criminal will inform the victim the issue can be removed for a fee. Criminals usually request payment through personal or electronic check or an electronic check with a bank or wire transfer or debit credit card or prepaid card or virtual currency. Another widespread issue is the fake refund. In this scheme, the criminal contacts the victim offering a refund for tech support services previously rendered. The criminal requests access to the victim's device and instruct the victim to log into their online bank account to process a refund. As a result, the criminal gains control of the victim's device and bank account. With this access, the criminal makes it appear as if too much money was refunded to the victim's account and requests the victim return the difference back to the criminal's company via a wire transfer or prepaid cards. In reality, there was no refund at all. Instead, the criminal transferred funds among the victim's own accounts, checking, savings, retirement, etc., to make it appear as though funds were deposited. The victims returned their own money to the criminals. The refund and return process can occur multiple times, resulting in the victims potentially losing thousands of dollars. Variations and trends, well, there are many of them. Tech support fraud was originally an attempt by criminals to gain access to devices to extort payment for fraudulent services. However, criminals are creating new techniques and versions of the scheme. Criminals pose as government agents or officials or law enforcement. The criminal offers assistance in recovering losses from a previous tech support fraud incident. The criminal either requests funds from the victim to assist with investigation or to cover fees associated with returning the lost funds. Criminals pose as collection services, claiming the victim did not pay for prior tech support services. The victim is often threatened with legal action if the victim does not pay a settlement fee. Then there's virtual currency. Virtual currency is increasingly targeted by tech support criminals, with individual victim losses often in the thousands of dollars. Criminals pose as virtual currency support. Victims contact fraudulent virtual currency support numbers, usually located via open source searches. The fraudulent support asks for access to the victim's virtual currency wallet and transfers the victim's virtual currency to another wallet for temporary holding during maintenance. The virtual currency is never returned to the victim, and the criminal ceases all communications. Criminals who have access to a victim's electronic device use the victim's personal information and credit card to purchase and transfer virtual currency to an account controlled by the criminal. Increasing use of victims' personal information and accounts to conduct additional fraud. Criminals use the victim's personal information to request fraud bank transfers or open new accounts to accept and process unauthorized payments. Criminals send phishing emails to the victim's personal contacts from the victim's computer. Criminals download personal files containing criminals send phishing emails to the victim's personal contacts from the victim's computer. Criminals download personal files containing financial accounts, passwords and personal data, health records and social security numbers and tax information. Additionally, IC3 complaint also reports of criminal who took control of victim's devices and accounts and did not release control unless a ransom was paid. Viruses, keylogging software, and malware were installed on victims' devices. Criminals have become more belligerent, hostile, and abusive if challenged by victims. Suggestions for protection. Remember that legitimate customer, security, or tech support companies will not initiate unsolicited contact with individuals. Install ad-blocking software that eliminates or reduces pop-ups and malware. Be cautious of customer support numbers obtained via open source searching. Phone numbers listed in a sponsored results section are likely boosted as a result of search engine advertising. Recognize fraudulent attempts and cease all communications with the criminal. Resist the pressure to act quickly. Criminals will urge the victim to act fast to protect their device. The criminals create a sense of urgency to produce fear and lure the victim into immediate action. Do not give unknown, unverified persons remote access to devices or accounts. Ensure all computer antivirus, security, and malware protection programs are up to date. Some victims report their antivirus software provided warnings prior to attempt. Well, if you're a victim, individuals who receive a pop-up or lock screen should shut down the device immediately. Ignore any pop-ups instructing to not power off or restart the computer. Victims who reported shutting down the device and waiting a short time to restart usually find the pop-up or screen lock has disappeared. Do not, and I repeat, do not, recontact fraudulent tech scam companies. Expect additional fraudulent calls as these companies often share their customer database information. Should a criminal gain access to a device or an account, individuals should take precautions to protect their identity. Immediately contact financial institutions to place protection on accounts as well as change passwords and actively monitor accounts and personal information for suspicious activity. File a complaint. Individuals who believe they may be a victim of an online scam, regardless of the dollar amount, should file a complaint with the IC3, and that's www.ic3.gov. It's a government agency. The more often fraud and scams are reported, the better equipped the enforcement can be made to address the issues. To report tech support fraud, please be as descriptive as possible in the complaint, including the following. 1. Identifying information of the criminal and company. Include the website, phone numbers, and email addresses used by the criminal and company or any other numbers that you may have called. 2. Account names and numbers and financial institutions receiving any funds. For example, bank accounts, wire transfers, prepaid card payments, virtual currency wallets, even if the funds were not actually lost. 3. Description of interaction with the criminal. And 4. Their email, website, or link that caused a pop-up or lock screen. Complainants are also encouraged to keep all original documentation, emails, faxes, and logs of all communications. Because scams and fraudulent website appears very quickly, individuals are encouraged to report possible internet scams and fraudulent website by filing a complaint with IC3 at ic3.gov. To view previously released PSAs and scam alerts, you could visit IC3's press room at ic3.gov/media/default.aspx.
Public service announcements of scheduled computer club meetings in the tri-state northeast region. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on Thursday. Presentation is on VLC Media Player and K3B for recording and playback and some editing file conversions of audio files. July the 12th at 7 p.m. They will meet at the NYU Silver Building, room 405 in Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group has their meeting on Friday, July the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the New York Institute of Technology at Old Westbury Campus, located at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane in the auditorium of the Harry J. Schur Hall. Princeton PC Users Group has a presentation on social media for small business, Thursday, July the 26th. Meeting time, 7 p.m., and they meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Brookdale Computer Users Group has a presentation on drones, sensors, and what are the applications for them. Thursday, July the 26th, meeting time is 6:45 p.m., and they meet at the Middletown Library Large Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society meets Tuesday, August the 7th, meeting time 7:30 p.m. at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey is off for July and August, but they will reconvene in September, Friday, September the 7th, meeting time 8 p.m., Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartow Avenue, Scotch Plains, New Jersey. All these club meetings are free and open to the public, and we hope to see you there at one of these meetings. At these club meetings, there is a random access period in which you can ask questions. There's no such thing as a dumb computer question, so attend one of these if you have a problem and you haven't been able to get it solved. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time
on WBAI FM 99.5 in New York, on the radio, or WBAI.org, streaming on the internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and until we meet again, same time, same station next week.